time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 10th of July. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by Island, the stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. You'll find them at Ocean View Road, Oniroa. On Saturday the 10th of July, Jan Scott talked to Manatai Schuster from Māori TV, Di Stoddard from Waiheke Library and John Coburn about civil defence.
It is my great pleasure now to introduce Manatai Schuster. Now, Manatai is the Head of Acquisitions and Commissioning for Māori Television. Welcome, Manatai.
Thank you very much, Jay.
Tell me, what is your? How did you get involved with Māori TV?
I've been involved from the very beginnings of Māori Television in various capacities, but have been working at the station itself since July 2004, almost my sixth anniversary coming up.
That's a fair while, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And the Māori Television went to air in 2004, didn't they?
Yes, they did, in March
2004. Right. What sort of lead-in time was there for that? When did the planning start?
The planning was a lot more generous than it had been for a previous attempt at setting up a Māori television service. So they had at least 2 to 3 years in the planning stages, which was very, very helpful towards getting it established. But it went through a very difficult birth process. But since it's launched and gone to air, it's become more and more a real television station.
Well, it is a real television station. In fact, I think it's a beauty. It certainly gives the other channels a run for their money. You've got some really good quality stuff on there.
Yes, we do. Despite the fact that 90% of our programming is locally produced programming, because it is a requirement of our legislation that we provide most of the programming for a supposedly core audience of Māori viewers. But in fact, since the station went to air, we've had a 70% audience of non-Māori, which is really encouraging to us.
Absolutely. How do you do your surveys?
Through the established AGB Nielsen company.
Right. Yes, I know a lot of people, including myself, who watch Māori TV on a regular basis because of the quality of your programs. You've got some great documentaries, some terrific movies, and some great cooking.
Yes.
Well, Kai Time on the Road and
Kai Order. Yes, absolutely. The documentaries and the feature films are part of my job. That's the hat I wear as head of acquisitions. So
that would be quite a tricky job, I would expect.
It's not so tricky, but it I think took a little bit of getting used to the idea of working internationally rather than just locally.
So does this mean you do quite a bit of travel?
Yes, I do. Not as much as I would like to, but I do get away at least once or twice a year to the various television markets around the world.
And what sort of criteria do you have when you're out looking for programs?
For us, it's very simple. We've got quite a narrow focus. For documentaries, for instance, we're most interested, first of all, in indigenous material, otherwise human interest and social issues type programming. And for feature films, we've gone for the niche market that mainstream don't appear to be too concerned about, and that's festival movies, art house type films.
Yeah, which there's quite a good, quite a large audience out there for, really.
Yes, there is.
When you look at how many people turn up at the movie festival every year.
Absolutely. And the only other way that people can view that type of film is by being subscribers to Sky and perhaps have Rialto as part of their subscription.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, a lot of people can't afford that.
That's right. Yes. So we're pleased to offer it free to air.
So how long have you been in the business, Manatai?
About 25 years.
And how did you get started?
Quite by accident. I sort of fell out of teaching after 10 years as a secondary school teacher into television with TVNZ. And I've never looked back since. I've been from one end of the spectrum to the other, producing programs, applying for funding, distributing funding, and now I'm at Māori Television offering all of that experience to them.
That's great. Were you part of the people, the group that put together Māori TV in the first place?
Initially, as my role as at the funding agency and part of my experience in this industry, for 6 years I was television manager at the funding agency, and it was our role to be part of the setup of the trust that was formed, first of all, to begin the strategic planning for the Māori television service.
And did that trust do some political lobbying to get the channel?
Absolutely. That was the main part of their job, and then from that point on to set up the core company that would operate the channel.
Right, and I guess that the charter that, I've forgotten which government it was now, brought in about having to have a certain percentage of locally produced programs on television and radio would have helped that process?
Well, I think Māori television was set up quite separately from the charter that was established to ensure that TVNZ maintained a good part of their schedule as public broadcasting. But certainly I think it has helped us as far as an audience is concerned, because we do feel we probably offer as much as a public broadcaster.
Okay, so Māori television wasn't set up because of the charter?
No. No, it was not.
It was in the process beforehand.
Yes.
Right, that's great. And whose brainchild was it? How did it come about, the whole idea?
Māori television, as it currently exists, was an idea that was probably mooted maybe 30 years ago, at the same time that they were establishing the Kohanga Reo and all of the new Māori language schools, because there was such a fear that we were going to lose our own language in our own country. So the schools were set up in the first instance, and they realised that the medium to get it out further than just an education domain was to have it available as a broadcasting service, whether radio or television. And of course, in the first instance, the government of the time set up the radio stations, the Māori radio stations, which are all over the country. And television, of course, was the next one, but that was a lot longer in the birthing process.
Yes, so how long was that birthing process?
The first attempt at setting up a Māori television service was the establishment of Aotearoa Television, that some people may remember. It also had a very difficult birthing process, but it existed for about 9 months. It was only meant to be ever a pilot service to see whether or not it could be done. And then it became a bit of a political football, and unfortunately that caused its demise. That was in 1996, and
wow.
It took until 2004 before we actually got another service up and running.
Gosh, yeah, that's quite a long gestation period, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Mind you, the country went through a very different change of mindset, didn't it, about accepting Māori language and culture.
Absolutely.
It changed dramatically over that period of time.
It did change dramatically, and that did help. But I think since Māori television has been on air, it's helped even more. There are more and more people now, and obviously with our 70% non-Māori audience, there are many more people out there who are wanting to become more aware of our language and culture, and themselves as well.
Yeah, and it's not just Māori language and culture that you're doing. I noticed there's one program which the name escapes me. I think you mentioned it earlier on. It's a food program, but you've got a lady in the background doing sign language.
Oh, yes, that's actually a gardening program.
Oh, that's right, about using different plants for different things.
Absolutely. And just that program was designed to help Māori people learn how to grow their own food and vegetables again. And it's been very good. And one of the producers belongs to the Society for Disabled Hearing. I'm not sure what it's called. And that's why they have the sign language in the corner.
I think that's a great idea, because it's unobtrusive. And yet it's allowing other people, you know, people who can't hear, to enjoy the program. And it's a very informative program too. I equated it with food because it was talking about plants and things and what you can do with them, you know,
yes,
medicinally and otherwise.
I think they were actually, in some parts of the programs, cooking some of the food that they were being able to harvest from the garden.
Yes, yes. I mean, that, it would be great if we knew what we could eat in our garden. That's not necessarily a recognised vegetable or fruit, particularly when you hit upon hard economic times.
Absolutely.
And there's such a lot out there that we could do if we knew what we were doing.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, now, no doubt establishing Māori TV would have been an expensive process. You know, the airwaves don't come cheap and that sort of thing. So how did you get the funding in the first place?
Oh, thankfully, the government recognised the need for such a channel to exist in the first instance because of movements that had taken place many years previously. The Privy Council had decided that the governments of the day would be required to provide a broadcasting service, radio and television, and so it wasn't anything that they weren't aware of, and thankfully they made funding available to be able to establish the channel.
Right, and since then there's been a trust set up to continue getting the funding, or how does that work?
It's actually a board. It's a board of executive directors, and you know the usual corporate structure underneath that, with CEO and all the various executive management and everybody else required to run a channel. It's only a small channel. We're only on air 8 hours a day, but we have two channels: one that is for the general audience, and then the other that is for fluent language speakers, and it broadcasts totally in the Māori language. But it's only on air for 3 hours a day.
Right. I'm in conversation here with Manutai Schuster, who is the Head of Acquisitions and Commissioning for Māori Television. This, of course, is the 50th anniversary of television in New Zealand. And when you look back on the last 50 years, it's what a huge change we've gone through. Last month, it was my privilege to interview Robert Boyd Bell, who's been involved in the industry for many, many years. And, of course, he was around not quite at the beginning, I don't think. Robert, if you're listening, I'm not suggesting you were there on day one. But we talked about how monochrome the New Zealand society was back then. And once coloured television came in, how that impacted on things. And I think, I wonder if now that we've got the Māori channel up and running and people are tuning into that, what sort of influence that's going to have when we look back in a few years' time.
Well, definitely a more colourful influence, yes. Which is all good, I think, for New Zealand society as a whole.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And have you noticed a difference in people's attitude toward Māori culture?
A definite difference. Living on Waiheke Island always helps, because many people that I meet every day on the ferry commuting across on a daily basis are often mentioning to me the fact that they've watched a really good program the night before. I'm hearing a lot more of the language being used in, just out and about in the community, which is really a wonderful step, I think, for us as a nation.
Mm. Yeah, one of the things I think is a little bit unfortunate about the advertising for Māori TV, and I get the Herald every day, and all that's listed the names of the programs. It doesn't say anything about what they're about. Unless you're fluent in the language, you may not even pick up that it's something you want to see, and you just sort of surf the channel and find, hey, why didn't I watch this from the beginning?
Absolutely. We are just as concerned about that, but all we can do is provide what they call the billings, and then it's up to the newspapers to decide how they publish those billings. We do send them out with much more information, and in some publications they do provide that extra information, but not so in the Herald listings.
No, that's a bit of a shame, because that's the one, I suppose, on a daily basis that people pick up.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But is there a more comprehensive one, perhaps, in the TV Guide?
Yes, TV Guide are very supportive of Māori television and often feature some of the particular programs that are coming up.
All right, because the listener doesn't either, I don't think.
No.
And the same thing for Triangle.
They do quote that they don't have enough space.
Oh, well, okay. you do have a website, I suppose, that
yes,
people
we do.
Could check out.
We've got a very good website, in fact.
And what is your website address?
Just www.mauritelevision.com.
That's easy to remember. And that has your schedule of
programs. Absolutely everything that you would need to know. It even has online programming that has been to air the night before. In fact, I think the programming is available for at least a month after it's gone to air, so you can pick up anything you may have missed.
All right. So is it there as a podcast or?
We're not streaming.
Oh, right.
I'm not
okay.
sure what podcast means, right. but we're not streaming currently. Well, some programs are streamed, but most you're able to just it's
watch
television
on
demand.
Oh, okay.
Mm.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm. Yeah, that's a great way to go. Almost like having your own home theatre.
That's right.
So where to from here for Māori Television?
I think just getting... making sure our local industry is producing even better quality programming. We still don't have as much funding to provide those producers as mainstream producers may enjoy, but they're getting better and better. Having Māori Television as a broadcaster has certainly helped our industry to grow and develop. So better quality programming, or even better quality programming. And maybe for me, it's being able to extend the hours on air. 8 hours is pretty good, but that's all we can afford to broadcast on a 24-hour basis. On a daily basis. And if we're able to extend broadcast hours, perhaps even at the weekends for a start, would be an achievement. But that's a little way off yet.
Yes, well, of course, that's how TV started off here.
That's right.
When the old Goodnight Kiwi used to come on at 10 o'clock or whatever. And if you did extend your hours, what would you put in those slots?
Well, for instance, if we extended our hours on a Sunday, we would then be able to have some religious programming. There is no room on our schedule for any of that at the moment. And other more family-type programs that just miss out anywhere on the schedule. Sunday, in fact, is a very good day for us. It's one of our highest rating evenings on television. So we thought if we extended that day to begin with, it would be interesting to see how it went as far as the audience was concerned.
Mm, absolutely. Do you have input from your audience as to what they want to see?
Oh, always. Since our website got up and running, I don't know what the number of hits are, but it's quite substantial. And there are always suggestions about what we could perhaps offer.
Have you picked up on any of those?
Yes, I have. Some even offering program ideas that I may not have come across in my role as head of acquisitions and commissioning. And I've discovered that, yes, that it was a good program, and we've eventually acquired and broadcasted on Māori Television.
Okay, so where would people have seen these programs?
It's interesting. Some in their travels, and others just from various festivals, film festivals that they have may have attended.
Okay. Yes, because you have... You do show a lot of, or quite a few documentaries about other Indigenous
yes.
people around the world, don't you, about the Ngui and the
yes.
Aborigine?
Absolutely, and that's an important aspect for us, as far as there's only 10% of the schedule that's available to me to slot those programs in, but I think it's a very important aspect to maintain as part of our broadcast schedule, because it allows our audience to view people from their own perspective and make up their own minds about what their reality is for those Indigenous people.
Right. Is there a difference for people working with on Māori TV as opposed to, say, Television New Zealand? If they're going through a broadcasting course, is there another aspect that they would...
Definitely. That other aspect, of course, is the language.
Right.
Many of us have worked through the industry. As I said, I've been working in it for 25 years, started out at TVNZ, was an independent producer. And the only thing that we need now more than anything is people with the language. And many more of them are going through the various television training schools around the country and coming through. Oh, I'm actually attending a documentary pitching session at Southeast Television next week, I think it is, where the students are pitching ideas to a range of broadcasters, not just Māori Television, and we judge them on how well they might fit. Our schedules, and some of those students are actually fluent Reo speakers, fluent Māori language speakers, and are going to pitch in their own language.
That's great.
Yes, it is.
So it's nice to know that there is a stream of people coming through to take over from the ones that are there at the moment.
Absolutely. It's very encouraging. And the next step for Māori television in-house is that there is more of an emphasis on the language being used during the working day, you know, in our working environment.
Right. Do you do that at the moment?
Yes, we do, but you know, not on a permanent basis like some of the other Indigenous broadcasters might. Our CEO visited S4C in Wales, TG4 in Ireland, and the Gaelic Channel. I forget what their name is right now. But he was most impressed by the fact that all people working within those stations were speaking their own Indigenous language during the work day.
Right. So does that mean that you really need to be a Māori person or have Māori heritage to work for Māori TV?
Absolutely not. We're quite multicultural at Māori television. Right. We've got a number of nations represented there. But they're all there because of their passion for what we're all endeavouring to do, to get our own programs, our own images, our own language out to the masses.
Yeah, well, one would expect that's why they're there.
Yes,
of course.
Absolutely.
Yes. And you know, it's really quite amazing, I think, when I look back, you know, through my childhood, and that I went to school with Māori people and whatever, but they didn't talk their own language.
No.
And I think, you know, it's quite recent, that their parents, you know, like my age group parents. Mm. A mother and father were actually not allowed to speak their language and were beaten at school if they did. And
absolutely.
And that so we've come a long way in the last 50 years, really.
Absolutely. I mean, the first kōhanga reo that was set up in the country by Dr. Peter Sharples, Hoani Waititi, some of those first foundation pupils are now in their 30s, right, and have many of them have succeeded extremely well, and many of them are working for Māori television, which is
great.
Really, you know.
Because the language was very, very close to dying out, wasn't it?
It was, and that was why there was such a push 30 years ago, nearly 40 years ago now, to ensure that the language had a place in the schools in the first instance and now in broadcasting.
That must have been a really tough struggle.
It was. And, you know, you may have seen, well, we are seeing on Māori television anyway, some of the early days of the political environment that was, and the images from those protests that were made and, you know, petitions being presented to the parliamentarians of the day about the need to support the learning of the Māori language.
Mm. Well, the documentaries that have been showing recently to celebrate the 50th anniversary really brought home to me what the political scene was like here 30-odd years ago that I'd forgotten about.
Yes.
You know, it's so easy to forget these things. You know, they say, you know, 2 weeks in politics is a long time. Because we've got such short memories.
Yes, we do.
And you watch those that footage and think, how on earth did we let that happen? Mm. You know, it's just amazing.
I think they're good, gentle reminders of where we don't want to go back to. And working in television, I see those images most of my working day. We're always using archival footage as part of documentaries, for instance, or any other programs that require that input. So I often see those. And we've just at Māori Television established a new program that incorporates the use of film footage from the New Zealand Film Archive. And that's due to go to air shortly. And we're really, really pleased to have developed that relationship with the Film Archive. You know, really keen to see it go to air because there are even more stunning images from as far back as 1901.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay, so what is that documentary called?
Oh, it's not a documentary. Okay. It's a series of programs, and they've done it in bilingual as well as a 100% language, Māori language. So some of them will be broadcast on the Te Reo channel, our 100% language channel, and the other half will be shown on Māori television. And it'll be bilingual and subtitled. And that's due to go to air very shortly. They're promoing it now.
Okay, what's it called?
It's called Ngā Taonga Whitiahua, which is the Māori name for the New Zealand Film Archive.
Oh, right.
Ngā Taonga Whitiahua.
Right. Yes, that's a very valuable resource that we've got.
Extremely.
Yeah, the New Zealand, what they used to be called, I've forgotten now, but, you know, when I was a kid at school, we used to have the old newsreels.
That's right, all of those.
And things that they would show us how Mr. Watty sort of put beans in cans and that sort of thing. And all of that is must be pretty fragile now, I would say.
Well, they've been
downloading it onto something else.
Yes, they are now. You know, a lot of it is being digitised so that it is compatible with the new technology and it ensures that those images will remain forever rather than wasting away, as film does tend to degenerate. But it is so important that those images still do exist.
Yes, gosh, I wouldn't have thought there'd be anything from 1901. That's amazing, isn't
it? Yes, there is. I think there might be. No, 1901 might be the beginning of it all. And it was. It's the images that will be shown in the first instance are of the visit of the King and Queen of England. I forget which ones right at this moment. They visited in 1901, and there was a very big welcome, Māori welcome to them. In Rotorua.
Right. Mm. Oh, yes, I've seen newspaper clippings of that, and I think Guy Rangi was there.
That's right.
Yeah, I didn't realise there'd be anything on film like that. Yeah. That'd be stunning to see.
It's quite amazing.
Yes, indeed. Now, I've just lost my train of thought on that. With that, it's really come as a bit of a
surprise.
A revelation.
Yes,
absolutely. One thing I find with the Māori television on the island is the reception is very good.
Oh, very good. I'm pleased to hear that.
I'm in Rocky Bay, and I get really good reception on Māori television. It's better than some of the others.
Very good. I mean, some people say they don't get such good reception. But you know, if you're a Sky subscriber, it's easy if you've got a satellite dish. But if you're not and you're still getting good reception, that's excellent news.
No, I'm not a Sky subscriber. I'm just on UHF. But I'm very, very lucky that I suppose I'm high up.
You're
not down in a valley.
In a good location.
But yeah. So what is the frequency if people want to tune in, if they're not already tuned in? Do you know what the frequency is?
Oh, my gosh.
That's right, because I know it's button 5 on my remote, but that doesn't help anybody out there. but I got Mike to who was the TV man on the island to come and tune my television some time ago, and he found it no problem.
Oh, very good.
But it will be on the website.
Yes, it will be. And they do have instructions about how to tune in.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fine. And the website is
www.MaoriTelevision.com.
So that's dead easy, isn't it?
Very easy.
Yes. Well, thank you, Manatai, for coming in and enlightening us about Maori TV. And best of luck for the future.
Thank you very much, Jan. I've enjoyed it.
Okay. Now, it's my pleasure to say hi to Di from the library. Hello, Di.
Good morning, Jan. How are you this morning?
I'm very well. And how are you on this chilly morning?
Yeah, it's chilly, but it's totally gorgeous.
Oh, stunning. I love these sort of days.
Yeah, I went for my morning walk this morning, and it was a nice frost that I had to walk through. So that was, I was hiding my thumbs.
Oh, yes, yes indeed.
Yeah, it has made the library a little bit slow this morning. Everybody's enjoying the day, I think, and it's not our normal really busy Saturday morning. But that's cool. They'll probably all come in a little bit later.
What time are you open to?
On a Saturday, it's 10 till 4 p.m.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So
it's quite a long time, yeah. Because sometimes when I arrive here for the program at about 9:45, there's a queue outside the door.
Well, that's right. They're all banging at the door on Saturdays. But it wasn't so like that this morning because of the beautiful day.
But then you would have had them banging on your door during the week. I would say, during that terrible weather we had.
Yeah, and of course, it's school holidays, so we're busy anyway. And then it's the holiday program, which we always run for primary school children. And because of a theme of superheroes and heroes, And, of course, we had the fire engine on last Wednesday, so we had, like, 75 people in the library.
You mean a real fire engine?
Yeah, yeah, and all the kids had rides, so it was very successful.
Wow.
So, the holiday program's always a great service to the community, really, because it's free as well.
Yeah.
And then we've got one more week left, and then this Wednesday at 11 o'clock... the theme is heroes, as I said, and it's the timing of the Rainbow Warrior, you know, the bombing 25 years ago today, actually.
That's right.
Today is the anniversary. And so we've got one of the heroes of the original Warrior coming to speak to the children at the library on Wednesday at 11 o'clock.
Who's that?
Oh, that's a secret.
Oh, it's a secret. Oh, wow.
I'm not letting you know which one
it is.
That's
fair enough.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's six of the original Rainbow Warriors off that boat actually live on the island.
Right.
And, of course, Martini,
who's one of our announcers,
he's one of them. And there's the opening, the premiere of the movie that was made about those six people is screening today in Auckland at 12:45 at the Sky City Theatre. And it's also on Monday if you want to go over at the same theatre at 11 o'clock. So it's quite an interesting movie about those six people and their lives on Waiheke today.
I'm sure it'll come to our cinema eventually.
Yeah, and reflecting back on their lives on the boat. And so we have a competition. So we have one of the warriors coming to speak about her experiences on the boat and what their role was and how it affected them. And to name the six warriors on the island, in number 1 to 6. We've got the poster in the you have to come into the library because that's where the poster is and that's where the people are. Mm. And there are photos of the warriors from the 80s, so it can be a bit challenging, but it's for the older kids, really. We're trying to...
And have you also got the names up there so they can put the name against the
face? That's right. Yeah. And there's fabulous Rainbow Warrior T-shirts to be won because they've made a batch of them for the 25th anniversary of the bombing. Yeah.
Right.
So that's all happening. So it'd be cool to have some older kids in older primary school, you know, like, and intermediate kids coming in for that Wednesday because it is for that age range more, and then we're making a big mural to go on the wall afterwards. So it's going to be another busy Wednesday, I think.
Oh, that sounds great. So how do you do the murals?
We're just going to make, it's going to be a long sheet of paper that once they've heard the stories of the warrior, then they can... draw what comes out of them about the that whole scene. So that's the holiday program. Next on my list to chat with you today, Jan, is everyone's talking about the girl with the dragon tattoo, and we've had the first movie, and the second movie's coming up end of July. And so what we did is that we've brought over lots of other Scandinavian authors, because that Scandinavian writers are really hot at the moment, and we can't keep up with bringing over extra Scandinavian authors into our shelves, and they're just flying off the shelf. So if anybody wants to branch out from Stieg Larsson, you know, who is the author of that Millennium Trilogy, if they want to try other Scandinavian authors, there's quite a selection there today. It doesn't last long, but we have them. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Wasn't the book that we all read for that month, that was written by a Scandinavian...
Yes, that was Larsson.
Isn't it terrible? I can't remember the name. Forgive me. But
Sonata for Miriam. Linda Olsen.
Right.
And although most of these Scandinavian people seem to write thrillers and crime and quite hard stuff, really. Mm. But some of the Scandinavian authors that you might recognise would be Henning Mankell. He's, quite well known. And Karen Fossum is as well. But I've got over some other authors like Leif Davidsen, Per Peterson, Helene Thurston, and there's Liz Jensen and Lynn Ullman and Håkon Nesser. So there's a whole bunch of them that, if you go into the website, AucklandCityLibraries.com and put in fiction, just that's one word, fiction, you can narrow it down to Danish authors, Swedish authors, Norwegian, and you can find that they just all pop up and you can order them like that as well.
So has the upswing in popularity for Scandinavian authors rubbed off on the old classics sort of like Ibsen and those or not?
There may be some people borrowing, maybe doing that through their own cards and coming through the system for them. I'm not aware of that. It's more like the newer crime stuff that seems to be the most popular. Yeah, and some names, of course, I can't even pronounce. But I didn't write those ones down.
Don't blame me.
There's two authors in particular go, oh, I can't say that. I don't even know how to say it.
Have you still got a waiting list for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Oh, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's huge. So, yeah, that's... and so we just thought, well, that's not very available for quite some time, so we'll just bring these other Scandinavian authors in if anybody wants to move sideways while they wait for Stieg Larsson's one.
Yes, because I guess they'd want to read the Stieg Larsson ones in order.
Yeah, oh, you have to read them in order for sure. Right. Yeah, they are fabulous.
Yeah,
and then we've got, I blew up, there's a story out of the Time magazine about Stieg Larsson's life and how it's all panned out and the dramas all around his death, and I blew it up a little bit and it's on the glass cabinet in the library, and it's actually attracted a lot of interest. There's a lot of people, you see a lot of people standing there reading about him, because that just about makes a novel in itself.
Yeah,
the drama
quite
of
a,
his life.
Quite a legal wrangle at the moment, isn't there, over his estate and who's got the rights to the last book or whatever.
Yes, yeah. And so, and the third and last thing that I'd like to share with everybody this morning is there's a real movement with building your own wood-fired pizza oven, which, of course, you don't just cook pizzas in, but you can roast chickens and cook your meat and make your bread and make cakes and whatever you like in them. But there's lots of books in the library system to show you how to make your own oven and the dimensions that you need. It's really important, and what you make out of what you make it with is really important. And it's so much fun, you know, social fun, having a pizza oven in your backyard or your front yard, and everybody's, you know, because it's like you make your own pizza basically. You make the dough, and all your guests are, you know, making that, rolling out their little bit of dough and putting what they want on their pizza, and it takes like 90 seconds to cook in the pizza oven. And yeah, so there's a gentleman I think coming in today who's just ordered some books over, because he's halfway, well, beginning to make his pizza oven, and there's quite a number of them on the island. So if anybody wants to get into that and make their own, they can, there's lots of books in the library that they can borrow. And, of course, I have to Skype because I've got a new one at home, and we had our inaugural pizza oven cooking last night. It's such a gorgeous social environment with that massive fire burning inside the pizza oven, and then it's all these coals that are just glowing red and orange. So, and then everyone's, you know, making their pizzas and popping them in the oven with the pizza peel, which is the long handled thing that you've got to, because I mean it's very, 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 very hot. And so yeah, it's all part of the life of the island, I reckon.
Oh,
is to have a
wonderful,
to
have especially on a cold
wood fired outside oven. Yeah, it's very cool.
Are there any requirements if you're building your own pizza oven, that you've got to pass any regulations,
no,
or get a permit or anything like that?
Not that I'm pretty sure I'm right. There's nothing that you need to do from council, no.
Right.
But, you know, it kind of fits that whole Adobe sort of Italian feel and holiday kind of feel that we have here.
Yes.
And, of course, you can use them in the winter and the summer because it's kind of warm around the fire. And, yeah, it's a lovely, lovely thing to do, and ours worked, which was fabulous.
Oh, excellent. That's very good.
Yeah, come and make your own pizza oven.
Yes.
Get the books out of the library, yeah.
That sounds like a great idea. And also get down there for the school holiday program, which is continuing right through to the end of next week.
Yeah, it does continue. We have that, the Warrior, coming into the library at 11 o'clock on Wednesday, but there's competitions that are running right throughout the holidays that the kids do at home and then come into the library and drop it off at the, on the last Saturday of the holidays. So the entry forms are in the library, so come in and pick those up, and there's an activity sheet for the kids to do at home as well. So, yeah, there's...
Do you have activities every day or just for the next week?
No, there's the stuff that they do at home that they can do, that they hand in, but the actual activities in the library is always on the two Wednesdays at 11 o'clock in the holidays. That's right. For an hour. That's right. Always standard, yeah.
Okay, and of course this coming Wednesday they're going to have, it's a Heroes Day, and they're having a Rainbow Warrior, one of the crew of the Rainbow Warrior that was sunk 25 years ago today.
Today,
coming along,
right,
to talk about it, and they'll be putting together, the kids that are there will be putting together a mural.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, to go
yeah,
up on the wall.
It's going to be really interesting.
So do they have to bring along their own... own pens?
No, we've got all the gear.
Great. So all you need to do is bring along your creativity.
That's right. And I think lots of parents, it's created a lot of interest amongst the adults, of course, that come into the library as well. So I think it will be there'll be older school kids, i.e. adults.
Fair enough. Yeah. And especially if it's if the weather's not that brilliant, that will be great.
So thank you. Thank you, Jan.
Thank you, Di. Mm. And don't forget to get on down to the library, particularly on Wednesday. But even if you can't make it Wednesday, there's always friendly faces in there and lots of good books to borrow. So
Lovely. Get
on down.
Thank you, Jan. Bye.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke People, Events and Issues, brought to you by Island, Art, Craft, Giftware, Clothing and Bric-a-Brac, Ocean View Road, Oniroa.
Now, it's my pleasure to introduce John Coburn. And John's come along to talk to us about civil defence. Now, John's not involved with civil defence as such. He's not an officer or an expert on the subject. He's a resident of Waiheke who's concerned as a resident of what we do in a civil emergency. Welcome, John.
Good morning, Jan. Thank you.
Now, I think what highlighted all of this for me anyway was the recent tsunami warning at Onitangi, but I live in Rocky Bay and we didn't get any indication of that at all, and listening on the radio, national radio and TV, they didn't once mention Waiheke or the Hauraki Gulf. So how do we hear about these things?
Yes, Jan, that's a very good question. Warnings are a problem all around the world, and the real problem is to warn or not to warn. That is the question. And if there is a warning, who should be warned? Now, a warning should comprise of three factors. That is to alert, to inform, and to advise what to do. Normally, we listen to the radio. And it's up to somebody somewhere to decide to send out that warning.
Right. And that somebody somewhere is probably sitting in an office in Auckland.
Yes, that's correct. First of all, it was in Wellington, of course. And the great problem really is that what happened in, I think it was 2005, when there was a Chile earthquake, and the warning went out from Chile that there is a tsunami on the way to New Zealand. And it was spread worldwide. This is during the Northern Hemisphere daytime. And people picked up the message off the BBC and CNN and immediately rang their friends and relations in New Zealand, who, of course, were asleep. Now, what happened then was that the Tsunami Warning Centre in the Pacific stood down the warning, saying, there is no tsunami, forget it. But the problem was that that message didn't go through BBC or CNN, and people in Wellington didn't bother to cancel the warning either. So the result was that some residents in Gisborne self-evacuated. The same thing happened in 2009, the first tsunami warning we had, is that Wellington were not sure if it was a warning or not, and putting it kindly, sat on their thumbs trying to figure it out, where meanwhile everybody around the country was wondering what they should do, if anything at all.
Right. One would expect that because we're a fairly isolated community here, we're not immediately attached to the mainland, that we'd have our own little system of letting each other know if there was such a thing. I mean, with the you mentioned earlier about the CNN and BBC people picking it up with the global communications we've got these days, people would pick it up from their televisions and perhaps be able to ring around if their friends and relations on the island.
Yeah, well, actually, the system, as I understand it to be, is that one way or another, the message will come to Waiheke. Now, regrettably, until very recently, it seems that Auckland didn't acknowledge that Waiheke is any different to anywhere else on the mainland. However, there has been a move to use the current fire siren in a variety of ways to signify a tsunami. The problem with that is that all warnings should be absolutely, totally clear, and people are used to the fire siren as being a fire warning. Also, keep in mind that at certain times of the year, 3 in 1 people on the island are from overseas. And for example, I lived in Australia for a long time. The first time I heard a fire siren, I thought it was a shark attack. So different warnings mean different things to different people. So there has been a move to put another type of siren on the island, but that has its own problems, and of course the experts are looking at that. The current system, I believe, is that fire and police will go to low-lying areas with their motor vehicles, which are equipped with PA systems to warn the people, and also door knock.
Right. And do they have a group of people on the island that will do that?
Well, this will be, I understand that it would be police and fire and volunteers. Whether or not other people might be involved, I'm not sure. I think that actually is something that should be developed, but at this particular time, as I understand it, that's the way it is.
Right. Well, I live in Rocky Bay, and of course we're isolated. We're a distinct community in our own right, and I would think it would be quite simple for us to, in that instance, to have a telephone tree or a group of us that go around and door knock and make sure everybody's right.
Yes, exactly, and off the record, those matters I believe are being looked at. And for example, there has to be some way where there is it is able to get the message into Rocky Bay, whichever way that might be depends on whatever is decided. However, it's quite interesting that what I think the change on the island will be, as far as these things are concerned, is until recently there's been various CDES, Civil Defence Emergency Services, meetings in the Ostend Hall. And they haven't been that terribly well attended, and mainly because they're not terribly exciting. So what has to be addressed now is, one, make them exciting and fun, and two, maybe it would be better to take them to the various residence associations halls, for example, in Rocky Bay, Ostend, Onitangi, and so forth.
That'd be a jolly good idea, I think.
Well,
people would come along locally, whereas they may not go out of a night, and especially in the wintertime, to the Ostend Hall or wherever. And sometimes, of course, they hold these meetings on a weekday when a lot of us are at work. So it would be a good idea to put something together in individual halls, local halls, and you could even have a social event afterwards or something.
Well, that's exactly what I believe is in mind, and it's something to be developed. And the critical issue here is that if enough people act, the leaders will follow. In other words, at this particular time, ACC has their own way of doing things, and they're quite dictatorial about how it should be done. However, after John Duthie's meeting a couple of weeks ago, there seems to be a change of attitude.
Yes, that is that's encouraging. Actually, there's quite a good article in the Marketplace this week on that meeting. One of the things I think was mooted was the possibility of using text messaging, and he's saying there that it would just overwhelm the system and make everything crash. Possibly that's something for further down the track when we get a bit more sophisticated with these things, is it?
Well, it is said in this world there are two groups of people. One group believe things can be done, and the other group believes they can't be done. And of course, they're all right. When I say we, those of us working unofficially, as it were, have been in touch with C-Link and Fuller's, and of course, they already have an SMS texting system in place to warn of interrupted sailings and the like. And it would seem a very simple thing to do to extend that to include disaster warnings. Whether or not that would overload the system is a matter of, I guess, what else is going on at the time. And I have spoken to the people who installed the texting system at Fuller's, and they tell me there is no possibility that in normal circumstances that the system will be overloaded.
Right. Well, of course, the Fuller's messaging service is only going to a certain number of people. It's not globally going to everybody who's got a cell phone. So maybe that's the thing that John was getting at, that John Duthie was getting at, that if a message went to everybody that's got a cell phone, then it's likely to crash the system. But if it was just an add-on to Fuller's service already, that might not be a problem.
Well, that's what they tell me. Now, also, I heard a couple of years ago that the council in Gisborne were so concerned about the now-deceased dolphin Moko, about people swimming out to annoy him, that they bombarded the area with SMS messages. This were the telcos who did this. So everybody within a certain geographical area got the message on their cell phone, please don't go out and interfere with Moko. Well, if Gisborne can do it, I don't really see why it can't be done in Auckland for Waiheke. And I have spoken to Telstra and Telecom, and they both tell me that there is not the slightest problem except possibly the invasion of privacy. But apart from that, technically, there is no issue.
Invasion of privacy, that's an interesting one. Where did they get that from?
well, I guess these people are very sensitive to invading people's privacy, because really that's what they're all about all the time.
I suppose what they're saying is they'd need the person's person to say, yes, I want that service. I want that facility on my telephone, like Fuller's did when they asked people to subscribe to that text messaging service.
Yes, well, that could well be so, but I don't think any logical thinking person is going to say, no, I don't want to hear when there could be a pending threat. And I go back to the 3-in-1 people on the island during holiday period. And of course, if those people got global roaming, then the island gets bombarded with those kinds of messages, then they'll pick up the signal no matter what. They don't have to subscribe to anything. They'll just know the same as everybody else would.
I wonder too if perhaps they're concerned about people panicking. You mentioned earlier about it, that situation with Chile, the earthquake in Chile, where the BBC and CNN broadcast a tsunami warning and then it was later cancelled. If they were to globally send out a text saying there's a tsunami on the way and then it was cancelled, people might already have been heading for the hills.
Yes, that's a very good point. But as I mentioned in the first place, a warning should alert, inform and advise. So the advice would be, there is a low-level tsunami alert, please listen to your radio. But we go back again to the situation in Gisborne in Wellington in 2000, and I think it was 2005. And there, simply because Wellington did not grasp the issue and put out the denial there was a tsunami, the rumour spread to the extent where, for example, I believe council officers in Gisborne were actually moving their computers uphill. It's probably the first time they've been outside their offices in ages. But anyway, and it did them good. But the issue basically is that if people only get half a story, the rumours will spread. So it's absolutely critical that the authorities grasp the issue at birth and control it.
Right. I was thinking about my childhood days holidaying in Rocky Bay, and in those days there was no road out of the bay. We were totally dependent on a boat. And we had a large piece of flat iron hanging outside the hall with a mallet. And if there was a fire, somebody banged on the flat iron, and it could be heard or reverberated all around the bay. It happened once because my great grandfather set fire accidentally when he dropped his pipe on the hill at the behind their cottage, and set that whole hill alight. And everybody turned up with wet blankets and goodness knows what else. But I think we've probably progressed from the flat iron days, but it is a concern to me, particularly for Rocky Bay, that fire is probably one of our most most likely scenarios. I can't see us being hit by a tsunami, but fire on the Rocky Bay Hill just would be a real problem.
Yes, indeed. Actually, this was addressed quite recently in the questions put to council. I might say the reason this article in John Duthie's Visit to the Island came about is because there's a great deal of dissatisfaction, such as your own from Rocky Bay, of what actually CDES are doing to help people on Waiheke.
Can we just clarify what CDES means?
Yes, it's Civil Defence Emergency Services.
Great, thank
and
you.
And I stress at this stage that any criticism that you might feel I'm making is directed not in any way at all to emergency services on the island. This is simply to the administration in Auckland.
Right. Okay, so John Duthie came over here as a result of people being unhappy about the earlier meetings.
Yes, can I just interrupt you there? What actually happened was that Councillor Roche understood there was dissatisfaction, and she asked the community what questions they would like answered by CDES. And hence, we went along to a particular meeting. We were told that the answers would not be presented at that meeting. It was a normal educational meeting, and there will be another one arranged later. That was the one that John Duthie ran 2 weeks ago, and very successfully, I might add.
Right. Was it well attended?
It was well attended. First of all, we got the answers in writing, and again, I don't want to appear to be hypercritical, but I'm going to be. But a lot of the answers, you would imagine, were being pasted out of a manual and pasted into a letter. Some of those questions, answers were distributed around the island, and also I had a blog with them on. And anybody reading those answers to the questions would say, well, why do we ever bother? And so I think there would have been a lot more people attend had there been more encouragement. However, I think there were I think in the article it says about 25 people, which is round about average for a CDES meeting on the island.
Right. If there were to be meetings in places like Rocky Bay, Palm Beach, etc., who'd run those?
Ah, the hard question, really. Okay. Well, actually, you see in the article that Waiheke is going to be allowed to take a degree of control over what it does. That is yet to be clarified. And at this particular time, it's quite nebulous. My personal belief is that if there is a real emergency, and the people have to, they do come under a near threat, then we're not going to be seeing the people from Auckland, probably, thank goodness, but we won't be seeing them. We'll be seeing police and fire and Coast Guard and Red Cross and so forth. And so I believe that these people should have a higher profile on the island, and therefore it would be my suggestion that they would be more involved with the residents' associations' meetings.
Yes, that makes sense indeed. One would think that Auckland would be very well organised when it comes to civil defence matters, because we're living with numerous volcanoes, most of which are still active, certainly not extinct. When you think of Rangitoto, it's a pretty recent one geologically. That that they should be well prepared for the likelihood of an eruption or a tsunami or whatever, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
That is not the case, and in fact, most definitely on September 30, it was not the case. And this didn't apply only to Auckland, I might add. This was nationwide, and the minister was so concerned that he called for an independent review. And that was carried out by a gentleman called Simon Murdoch. And at the same time, John Hamilton, who is a national director, he took out an internal review. So you have an internal review and then you have an external review. And reading through those really makes one's hair curl. I would say it's appalling. But that was then. And we're not really wanting to talk about too much about how bad it was. As somebody once said, it's not how we got here, we're here, and where we go from here that matters.
Absolutely. So where do we go from here?
Well, again, when the people act, the leaders will follow. What I'm hoping will happen is there will be more publicity concerning this, put out to people on Waiheke, and it's up to them really to make their contribution. And the problem basically is that there is a great deal of apathy towards civil defence and all those related disciplines, simply because people's basic instinct is that they'll look after us. Well, they'll won't. They won't here, they won't in London, they won't anywhere at all. So it's up to the people really to decide what they want to do. And as far my concern mainly is to make the whole issue fun. I don't mean to make a tsunami bearing down on a beach anything funny, but the education system as being fun.
Well, that would be a good idea. Maybe we could have a civil defence day, when the weather gets warmer, encourage the community board to have a civil defence day, and we could all act as victims or whatever.
Yeah, we're all victims. We're all victims. Well, actually, I was speaking to a very good friend of mine just last week, actually, and he works for a company, a Fortune 500 company, operating also in Auckland, and they have a very fixation, if you like, with health and safety. And worldwide, I think they employ about 50,000 people, and their accident rate worldwide is incredibly low. In fact, in New Zealand, it's in the very lowest category as far as ACC rating is concerned. And what they do around the world, in every company, every location, they have the employees divided into groups of 12. And once a month, the two members from each group has to present to the other 10 members a presentation on safety or health and safety. Now, that could be almost equally as boring as civil defence. But this friend of mine, he and his mate, they got together, and what they did, they made a PowerPoint slide show of a bushman in South America. And of course, he's standing there in his loincloth with trees all around and all the rest of it, and his mates are standing there with spears and whatever else they carry around with them. And he got a lump of sacking, and he wound it all the way down his arm, from his armpit over his hand, a great big thick wadding of it. Having done that, he plunged his arm as far as it will go down a hole in the ground. You might ask, why would he want to do that?
Well, exactly.
I'm glad you asked.
Why would he want to do that?
Well, he waited a while, and then he gave a signal with his other hand, pulled out the arm he'd thrust down the hole, and hanging on the end of it was a walloping great anaconda.
Ah.
Yeah, snakes alive.
Yes.
Of course, this was no surprise to his mates, because that's why they were there with their spears and machete and all the rest of it. And so they did whatever bushmen do in South America when their mate pulls an anaconda out of a hole. But anyway, they seem to have great fun because they're whooping and shouting. Anyway, there's a PowerPoint slide presentation made of this, and the principle of health and safety here was to wear protective clothing.
Ah, yes.
So you see, all it requires is a great deal of, not a great deal even, a degree of creativity. And Waiheke people are well known for their creativity, so I wouldn't have imagined that there would be any problems getting really good ideas from the various groups.
Well, that's true. Yes, as you say, if we could make it fun. The thing is, of course, with health and safety, usually you're in an environment where you know it. There is a certain degree of danger, and therefore you're probably wearing protective clothing in the first place. With a civil defence matter, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know where you're going to be when it happens, and that's one of the tricky things, isn't it? You can be as prepared as you like at home for your civil defence with your emergency kit and all the rest of it, but you may not be at home when it happens.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And we need only look back to, well, just, what, 10 years, less than 10 years, when you had 9/11. Now, in New York, security and all the rest of it, prior to September, was already pretty high for various reasons, but nobody... Actually, that's not entirely true, but the majority of people did not anticipate three planes crashing into the Twin, or two planes into the Twin Towers, and one aiming for the Pentagon. So that was totally unexpected. And when I say unexpected, there was a couple of years before, as I understand it, a person studying for, I believe it was an actuarial degree. And anyway, these sort of people speak a language that I can't even begin to understand. However, he was writing a paper for the worst possible insurance loss the world could envisage. And he actually, more or less, in his paper, prophesied the 9/11 event. And the spooky thing is that when he extended the losses, that is, losses of property, losses of rent, losses of lives, pensions, and all the rest of it, he was quite accurate. But his paper had been read and filed away.
Uh-huh. Well, yes, because who'd have thought that would happen?
Well, again, we have, this time last year, if you were writing an emergency defence program in, say, Louisiana, where would your main focus be? It would be on hurricanes. And what actually has happened? It's oil. I was unlucky enough, if you like, to be in Sydney back in September last year, 28, I think it was. We arrived at the airport, or actually, we had to get to the Sydney airport quite early. And I woke up in the morning around about 4:30, and the sun was coming up, as it does. And outside the window, there was this metallic, goldy kind of hue. And I thought, that's funny. So I walked outside, and it wasn't the tinting on the glass or whatever. It was actually a tinted light. It turned out that a dust storm had swept over New South Wales, and then from Queensland, I think, actually, or a big storm, windstorm had swept down, picked up dust off the dry areas and dumped it on Sydney big time. This had never, ever been known before, and so therefore there'd be no planning for it. However, being the sort of people we are, we had no choice, actually, because we had to leave where we were living. They were glad to get rid of us, I think. We drank all their beer. And we made our way to the airport. And we were told, it was chaos there actually, all the international flights were taking off, but the Trans-Tasman ones were not. And we sat there all day looking out the window at dust. And eventually we took off very late in the night. Meanwhile, there had been, I think, three flights out of New Zealand towards Sydney and Melbourne, and they got halfway and they were told to turn back because there was no facilities for them. And I believe there was a very important group of people who were going to a very important meeting, and they took off at early hours, spent most of the day flying, and returned to exactly where they were.
Yes, indeed. And of course then there was the issue of that unpronounceable volcano in Iceland that caused havoc with the volcanic dust over Europe.
Would you like me to pronounce the name for you?
Oh, if you can.
No, I can't, sorry.
Right. Yes, and who'd have predicted that scenario?
Well, actually, because it was known to be active, somebody should have, but the reality is nobody appeared to. The result of all that seems to be that mainly most planes could have flown, as it seems to turn out. There was one plane in England that was especially equipped to measure the amount of dust and ash and all the rest of it in the atmosphere. And it would have been a simple matter, really, for it to have taken off, flown through the dust, the ash cloud, got its readings, signaled back, and service would have resumed or not. Guess what? It was down for maintenance.
Dear, oh dear. Well, this is it. You just can't predict these things, can you?
No.
And I guess in that situation there was an unusual group of events, being, you know, the wind direction and the weather conditions and things like that, that in the past it hadn't affected such a wide area, but everything just came together to make that happen.
Yeah, I think that phenomena is called Sod's Law.
You could be right.
And it's during the various educational processes put on by CDES, they go to some great lengths to explain the likelihood of this and the likelihood of that and all the rest of it, which I guess we should begin to understand. But the most important thing is that preparation should be for the very worst, and it shouldn't be the very worst if so-and-so happens. It should be just the very worst. And in fact, there is a saying, reference earthquake, there was a saying which was attributed to Professor Richter, who of course developed the Richter scale, that the only people claim to predict earthquakes are charlatans, fools, and liars. And I read a couple of days ago a gentleman specialising in this thing in, I think it was Victoria University in New Zealand. He didn't say it in those words, but more he did say words to that effect.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Well, of course, I think he's probably right, because Mother Nature doesn't take notice of smart people who think that they can read her mind.
Absolutely not. And
who can read a woman's mind? Let alone Mother Nature.
Oh, yeah, of course it is. If it's Father Nature, it would be quite predictable, wouldn't it? I lost my track now, sorry.
No, that's all right. We sort of got off the track a wee bit. What would you suggest that people do, that they can do, that, for instance, I can do to prepare for a natural disaster or civil defence emergency?
Well, the saying is that no man or woman is an island, and so there. And also, of course, there's the very important issue of the collective brain, as it's known, which is, if you like, community knowledge. And so, the most important thing, I guess, is that people should become aware, and become aware that they are a part of a community, and work with that within the community and with the community to spread the awareness, and also what to do when the worst occurs. And the general instruction from Auckland is that if there is an emergency, please stay in your home. That's where you should remain. Of course, we have the problem on Waiheke that in certain parts of the year, 3 in 1 people don't have homes. They might be living in a hotel or backpackers or whatever. So what do you do with them? That's a problem.
Yes, if something disastrous happened at our peak season, it could be a real problem, couldn't it?
Indeed,
or more of a problem.
Indeed, it could be a problem. And I've been very concerned for quite a long time about how 30,000 people on the island, we'll say, are going to be provided with food from 8,000 residents when, according to Auckland's figures, only 7% of those residents are going to be fully prepared themselves. So I've been very concerned about food supply. I know it sounds quite out of the ballpark, if you like, but that's the reality of it, that if we're cut off from the mainland for, say, 3 days, and we have only 3 days' supply for 8,000 people, and there are 30,000 people to share, the police are going to be very busy. It is going to be looting and all the rest of it. However, at the meeting, John Duthie's meeting, a member from the Coast Guard put his hand up and said, well, that's no problem because, well, it is a problem, but it's a problem with a solution. And the solution simply is that Auckland City Council can commandeer whatever they like. So they would take supplies, presumably from Woolworths and all the rest of it, dump it in a barge, not necessarily a sea link barge, which they also requisition, and then I presume Coast Guard or some brave people would drive it round to the lee side of the island and run it up on a beach. And of course what would then need to happen is would need to have volunteers there to actually take the supplies off the barge. So that has been addressed, but it's very important that these things are rehearsed. Because there is a saying that the best played, what is it called? The best laid military plan stops working upon first contact with the enemy.
Uh-huh. Yes, and of course, I guess if, for instance, if Rene Toto erupted, then our lifeline to Auckland wouldn't be there. We'd have to look perhaps to Coromandel. And support from that end of the island rather than the Auckland end.
Those are the situations that really should be thought through by not people on the island at all. This should be what is thought through in Auckland. The way that I see it is that Wellington at every moment say they have no control about Auckland. According to the Defence Act or whatever it's called, Civil Defence Act, then Auckland has total control over what it does. I'm not entirely sure that's accurate. I think they have a lot of control, but I think they work within guidelines put out from Wellington. However, what seems to happen between Wellington and here on Waiheke, there are a number of boards, civil defence boards, and I can't remember all their initials. But again, I am being critical. But they seem to think that one plan fits all. Well, it doesn't. That's the reality of it. What is good for St Helier's is not good for Rocky Bay, and so therefore, what we should be doing, we should be having input into the civil defence plan from the very beginning. We should help maintain it. We should rehearse various emergency drills. I don't mean to the extent of having military exercises, that's not necessary, but in residence association hotels, you know, that sort of thing. Not hotels, did I say hotels? I meant halls, sorry, I'm wishful thinking. Residence halls and all the rest of it, but people must be involved. And importantly, critically importantly, is that after an exercise or after an alert, there should be a review. And there was none after the first one, the second one, or the third one. In fact, I am told that the community board here did advertise contributions for a review. The problem was that went into the Waiheke marketplace, I think it would have been Wednesday. On Monday, the first day after the alert, the councillor Lister, responsible for this in Auckland, he wrote a letter of congratulations to all concerned, saying, what a fantastic job you did. Of course, he was over there in Auckland, but he had no idea what was going on over here in Rocky Bay. And if I may, I'll introduce an issue here, and it goes back to the warning, whether to warn or not to warn. As it happened, there was a person in Rocky Bay who I happen to know was flying out from Auckland Airport to go to Melbourne on a business meeting that very morning. I quite often wake up early in the morning, and when I do, I tune into the net and read what's going on around the world, except when England's playing in the World Cup, when I go good great lengths to move away as far as I can. Anyway, I heard about the tsunami alert, and I rang the family to say, if you're thinking of getting a ferry, then you want to check that they're running on time, because they might be cancelled. Anyway, that's exactly what he did. He had planned to catch the 10 o'clock boat. That one, in fact, was cancelled. And so had he missed that, he got the 9 o'clock, but had he missed it, then he would have missed his flight and he would never have arrived in Melbourne. Now, you could say, oh, well, that's tough. So what? Well, it could well be that he wasn't, but it could well have been that he was an eminent surgeon, and he was flying urgently to, we'll say, the centre of the world, wherever you think that might be, Switzerland, we'll say, to be a team member on a very important operation on a very important person in the world. And his presence was critical. Well, because he didn't get the plane, he's not on the team, the operation could have been a failure, and the patient died. Now, that could have been avoided had he received so what I'm really saying, that when a person decides to warn or not to warn, if they decide not to warn certain people, then they have to know absolutely and totally the calendar of the people they're not warning. And of course, the downside is that if you warn everybody and the threat never arrives, then people are going to be annoyed.
Right, but perhaps what you're saying is better to err on the side of caution and warn everybody than not to warn and get somebody caught out.
Well, absolutely, and there was a real case, and a very sad case actually, during the Victorian bushfires, and I think it was at a place called Churchill. I can't be sure of that, but I think it was. And what happened was, everybody knew there was a fire, and the fire was blazing merrily, well, not merrily, but ravenously. And I don't know if you've ever been up close to a bushfire, but they are absolutely the most frightening thing. The local commander on the ground, the fire commander, he got the information that there would be a wind shift somewhere between 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock. At that particular time, the fire was not heading in his direction. But if there was a wind shift, then it would. So he made a judgment that he would take the average time, i.e. 7 o'clock, and advise various residents. Now, bear in mind, these residents are far-flung. They're not grouped together in a town. He made the judgment that he would take the average at 7 o'clock. The reason being, he didn't want to inconvenience them if it didn't arrive late or if it didn't arrive at all. And secondly, the drill is that when they get the warning, they turn on their sprinklers, the sprinkler system, and he didn't want to waste water. Well, the terrible reality was that the fire actually changed direction at 6 o'clock. The fire swept through the hamlet, and there were a lot of people killed, unfortunately. It was a terrible thing, and of course the poor fire commander, he has to live with that for the rest of his life. But it is a hard judgment call to make, and of course if nothing ever happens and you get woken up from your sleep in the middle of the night, you feel not entirely happy towards whoever woke you up. But that again is where the education process comes in. People should be advised that if there is a warning, it is really to the best of the community. And if there is a minor inconvenience, maybe better that than a disaster to a small part of that community.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. Yes, it would be a hard call to make, really, wouldn't it? And it's a terrible burden to put on one person, I guess.
Well, yes, it is. And, of course, people are trained to do this. And, unfortunately, according to our current system, the chairman of the community board, and I'm in no way pointing a finger here, but the chairman of the community board on the island is responsible for civil defence. But he's had no training. And you can't expect a person who, in his case, is a school teacher one day to become a specialist civil defence emergency services operator the next. And what really should happen, there should be proper training. My own belief, for what it's worth, and I doubt that it'll be listened to, but my own belief is that it should really come down from the fire. The police. Because the police are authoritative, they are hierarchical, they are trained in these matters, and people tend to listen to police where they might not listen as attentively to, say, fire or anybody else.
Yes, that makes sense, doesn't it? But we've got a long way to go before we get to that, I guess.
Not necessarily. The great thing to do, of course, is to identify the problems and say, OK, that's a problem, how can we resolve it? And as I said before, there are two groups of people, those who can and those who can't. And it will be hopeful that those who can do prevail.
Right, so where to from here, John?
Where to from here? Well, at this time, I'd actually like you to give a little tip that you can do immediately. Everybody listening in, please, and you, Jan, Take out your mobile phones. Please, Take out your cell phones. You got yours. Everybody got theirs? Okay, now go into your address book or contacts, whatever it's called. God, you got a lot of people in here. go into Edit. Now, scroll down to the name and telephone number of the person you would like to have notified if you are involved in an accident.
So that would probably be your next of kin, I suppose.
Next of kin, right. It would normally be. And preface that number with the letters ICE. That's India Charlie Echo. Now, ICE is the international recognised letters for in case of emergency. And the idea is that you then put your phone back in your pocket, your handbag, wherever you keep your phone. It doesn't have to stay on even. But if you are found in a car accident or whatever, then emergency services can come along. They don't know who you are. They pick up your phone, go into the alphabet to I. There is ICE, and they just push the button and say, okay, we've got some bad news for you, but whose phone am I calling from? Yeah. In other words, you're immediately identified. Just a matter of interest, this came about from the tube bombing, which was just over 5 years ago in London, of course, on the 7th of July, when a lot of people who travelled on the same tube every day, but in the good English way, they had no idea who each of them were. They were stumbling along the railway line in the dark and all the rest of it. Some were dragged out, some were very badly injured, some were unconscious, and emergency services had major problems in a short space of time to contact an awful lot of relatives. So out of that came the ICE on telephone, mobile telephone concept.
That sounds like a really good idea, and I hope everybody's done that out there. Thank you for suggesting it, Don.
Okay, now there's just one issue, of course, that if the husband puts in his wife's ICE and the wife puts in her husband's ICE and they're travelling together and they have, say, a prang and they're both unconscious, then emergency services will press each ICE and each other's phones will ring. So it would be a good idea to have maybe two people there, one your next of kin and maybe a very good friend who usually you're not travelling with.
That makes an awful lot of sense. And we've been talking to John Coburn about civil defence and what you can do in an emergency, and we thank him very much for his input. Thank you, John.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirola.